The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 85. The appearance of the National Teacher's Monument. No pointer. When you have the mallet to smash space and the ability to rend a mountain, then for the first time you arrive at where there are originally no seams or gaps, where you don't see any flaws or scars. But who is such a person? The main case. Emperor Suzong asked National Teacher Zhang, "After passing away, what will you need?" The teacher said, "Make me a seamless monument." The emperor said, "Please tell me the monument's appearance." The teacher, after a silence, said, "Understand?" The emperor said, "I don't understand." And the teacher said, "I have a disciple to whom I've transmitted the teaching named Danyuan. He knows about this matter." Later, the emperor summoned Danyuan and asked him about the meaning of this. Danyuan said, "South of Zhang, north of Tan, there in his gold, filling the whole country, under the shadowless tree, the communal ferry boat, in the crystal palace, no one who knows." The verse. Solitary and transcendent, round and full, where the power of the eye ends, it towers high. The moon descends, the pond is empty, the color of night is deep. When the clouds recede, the mountain is lean, the faces of autumn many. The positions of the eight trigrams, right, the energies of the five elements harmonize. The body is in there before. Have you seen it? Nanwang, parent and child, seems to know it exists. The Buddhas and ancestors of India can't do anything about it. I was thinking about how many of you from home have mentioned over the months how you can hear sounds coming in from the Zendo in March when we still had the heaters on, the crinkling of the heaters, and April and May, the morning bird song, and how good that was to hear those sounds, and how kind of many of you said it sort of brought you into the space because you have that physical memory of being here and hearing those sounds. So I was wondering if you had been hearing these sounds this week. We're sort of in a construction sandwich. Bridge to the south being built, so this endless driving pile driver. And to the north, the Jizo house, hammers and saws, building something. Nanyuan Huizhong was a teacher. He was a disciple of Huineng. So this is early in the Zen tradition. And I remember first hearing about this teacher many years ago and just assumed that because he was a national teacher, he was sort of, I don't know, not quite credible somehow. But he was a really... said to be had been a really fine teacher, very well known, and he was called the National Teacher because he taught three different reigns of emperors, and so this took place actually very close to the end of his life. He was getting ready to die, which is why the emperor was asking him this question. And he began studying at a very early age. He lived in the 8th century, essentially. He was about 100 when he died. And he lived at a time, having studied with Huanung and on East Mountain, which was a very, very sort of prolific, important place where Zen was developing. And there were a lot of schools that were appearing at that time. And he never really identified with any of them, but went on to be a great teacher. Once he said to the Sangha, "Those who study Zen should venerate the words of Buddha. There is but one vehicle for attaining Buddhahood, and that is to understand the great principle, that is to connect with the source of mind. If you haven't become clear about this great principle, then you will find it very difficult to embody the teachings, and it will be like a lion cub whose body is still irritated by fleas." Once a student asked him, "How can one become a Buddha?" And Huizhong said, "Cast off the Buddha and every being, and at that moment you'll be liberated." Once a student asked, "How can I be in accord with it?" And Huizhong said, "Don't think of good or evil. Personally see Buddha nature. See it for yourself." Another time a student said, "How can we attain the pure Dharmakaya, the pure body of the Buddha?" And the Huizhong said, "Don't seek Buddha. Don't ask the Buddha. Don't expect to be saved by Buddha." There's a thread here, something that runs through these various teachings of his. Cast off Buddha and all beings. Don't think of good or evil. Don't go seeking Buddha. And so here, this the emperor asks him, what will you need after you pass? What can I do for you? And this is a real question. The footnote said, from the beginning, he doesn't lack anything. And that's true for the emperor, it's true for Huizhong. The emperor, of course, has great wealth, great power, so he could essentially grant Huizhong anything he wanted. What does Huizhong ask for? "Make me a seamless temple." The emperor is saying, "How can I repay this debt of gratitude? How can I serve you after you've passed?" This is a real question. It's an important reason why we develop a living relationship with the ancestors, Buddha ancestors, men and women, all the way back, within our lineage and beyond our lineage. That's why I think it's significant to note that Huizhong did not align himself with any particular school. Schools are valuable. They sort of carry a tradition through the ages. It's how it's sort of the vessel that we enter into. But they're impermanent, first of all, and they're upaya. Master Dogen has an old fascicle where he goes on and on about how the Buddha never used the word Zen. He never talked about Zen. That we study Buddha Dharma. And just as Huizhong said, those who study Zen should venerate the words of Buddha. There's only one vehicle. There's only one vehicle. And so we express our gratitude. We say the names of those who have come before us, just some of them. We express gratitude. So a daily repaying of that debt of gratitude. It reminded me of a poem I wrote for Dada Roshi at one of his memorial services. And at the end of it, I said, "As before, my gratitude sits empty in a hollow mouth. Enough, you say, enough. Bow and withdraw. Let the mountain body Dharma speak in the tongue of falling leaves." Huizhong said, "Make me a seamless monument. Make me a seamless temple." Anything we create is going to have seams. Right? The sides joined together, edges stitched together. Even if something is created without any seams, is made as one whole, object, there's still the seams above and below, between inside and outside, where that body meets the world. And those boundaries, those apparent boundaries that seem to define that object and differentiate it from the world, in that gap, that's the place where heaven and hell are born. That's the place where samsara is created. Inside the body are flesh and bones, organs, blood. Outside is wind and rain, people and buildings. How can we find peace amidst so many things? Make me a seamless temple. The footnote to that says, where do you start? Where would you begin? Everywhere we see differences, people, objects, situations, emotions, thoughts, ideas, histories. And all of those are born in that gap, in that space between. Buddhism speaks of the bardo, the between. Between sleeping and waking, between delusion and enlightenment, between this life and next life, between this moment and the next moment. What is that between? In that space is where distinctions are born. Names form on our lips. Ideas come into being. We remember. We tell stories. These are the seams. Huizhang says, make me a monument, a temple with no seams. The Buddha realized that those seams, those all-important gaps, that so much of the time we don't notice, we don't see them as gaps. We see them as solidity. We see them as continuity. We see them as seamless, when all we're looking at is seams. Something is there, what is it? And in that gap, the mind gets uneasy, anxious, restless. And so it starts tinkering. It adds something to fill in that gap, to make the connections. And then adding something, it adds a little bit more, and then a little bit more. And if we look closely, what we see in all of that construction is ourselves. Various faces, various expressions of ourself. Huizhang says, connect with the source of your mind. Connect with mind itself. Cast off the Buddha. Don't dwell in thoughts of right and wrong, heaven and hell, you and not you, practice and not practice. And don't go bothering the Buddha about all this. Don't sit here and wait to be saved. The emperor says, tell me, what will it look like? Reasonable question. That which you want me to make, what will it look like? How should I begin to design it? How will I know when it's completed? The footnote says it can't be fully depicted. Interesting. It can't be fully depicted. We can say words, we can point, we can draw, we can use poetry, metaphors, images, all kinds of ways of depicting it, but never fully. Huizhang was silent. And then he said, do you understand? A teachingless teaching. What he was really saying in that silence was, connect with your mind. Don't think good and evil. Don't seek apart. Don't expect anything. The emperor says, I don't understand. An honest answer. The footnote says here, you can't understand. Though not understanding, don't seek elsewhere. That's so important. When we meet an impasse, when we meet frustration, annoyance, insecurity, don't seek elsewhere. That moment is propitious. The reason it's irritating, the reason it's annoying, the reason it's under our skin is because that gap is being poked. There's something there. And that's such a matter of faith, because we have been so taught to perceive that as wrong. Something is wrong here. The signs of the irritation and the annoyance and the frustration and judgment, and those are all signs that something's wrong. And so seeing that gap, perceiving it that way, we go about correcting that wrong by creating more gaps, by creating something that is guaranteed to itself appear at some moment again as wrong. Don't seek elsewhere at such a moment. Don't be in such a rush. Be patient. Stop. Look closely. You know, I remember struggling with this so much for so long, and gradually beginning to see that those moments, rather than just experiencing those moments as some, why is this happening to me? This shouldn't be happening, right? If my practice was good or better or something, if something else was happening that should be happening, obviously, this wouldn't be happening. So what's that thing that should be happening? Because this is a sign that something's wrong. I was so sure of it. How could that not be so? And to defy that, to not bow down and serve to that, and say no. I don't know what happens next. I don't know much. But I know what happens if I just go the same way. It's sort of like Rudy. Right? So twice in a row, he's teaching us. Right? He's teaching us how to get his attention, right? And get what he wants. Right? How quickly habits are born. Rudy is the cat. And so if you didn't get in on the drama in the last couple of days, he comes at the door same time today and yesterday, same time, right before the talk, and both times loving monks got up to give him what he wanted so we could expect him here tomorrow. Wouldn't you? So it's hard. It's hard not to like trust what seems so clearly true. This pain, this discomfort, this dis-ease, it's like when we're sick, right? I mean, that's why suffering is compared to sickness, a kind of sickness, an existential sickness, except the way we respond to it when we're sick, right? There is something that is a balance that has been lost, and it gets our attention, right, to correct it, to heal ourselves. But here, fundamentally, the illness is not an illness at all. It appears as an illness. And in that appearance, the rest will follow. The emperor says, I don't understand. The footnote says, now you're getting somewhere. Don't know so much. Don't understand. You know, and the thing is, we don't, when we're at that moment where we pivot, something arises and the impulse is there. We know exactly, you know, the energy is there, the impulse is there to respond in that familiar way. And because of practice and sufficient mindfulness, we can see that. And now it's larger. Everything has become larger. We're able to see more clearly. And so just to hold steady and not give way to that impulse. You don't have to know what happens next. We don't have to know. Needing to know is, okay, having created this, this doesn't work. So if I don't create this, then what do I need to create? And that's what Huizhang's saying. No. Build me a seamless monument. What kind of construction is that? That's why the poem says, solitary and transcendent, round and full. Where the power of the eye ends, then it towers high. At the limit of our capacity to see, now, there is where it really becomes large. You know, Buddhist practice really is just about these gaps, the seams, the breaks, the tears. So that we can see them, recognize them, experience them in all of the different ways we need to. Through our senses, through our mind, through our awareness, through our understanding. Again, because before, although we know something is not right, that's why we go seeking to begin with, those very things that we begin to realize are, those gaps are the source of our suffering, before many of them have been the strategies to find what we're looking for. But when we stop and begin to examine into that space, see into that space, the space between and the space within, now, what is there? Are there so many things? What is it that we trip over? The poem says, the body is in there before, have you seen it? Nanyuan, parent and child, seem to know it exists, but the Buddhas can't do anything about it. We too, at our own place along the way, seem to know it exists. How else can we explain it? Right? I mean, really, it just doesn't make sense. From within our own delusion, from within our own particular little universe, seeing things as we do, right, largely unexamined, and taking that for the world and the universe and life and the whole thing, because that's what it seems to be happening all around us. How do we then go from that to encountering the Dharma, limitless boundlessness, selflessness, and hear that as something familiar, as something that you already know? And so we see into that separation. That's why we have to sit and stop and have patience and sometimes forbearance, where you're practicing the best you can, and that which has got you by the ankle or the throat, it won't leave you alone. You're practicing and it won't leave you alone. It's still there. Right there is the pivot. Right there. Interrupt the cycle. Break the cycle. Do something unheard of. Don't build. Don't build anything. Or if you're going to build, build a seamless monument. There's so many teachings about how we create those gaps. In meditation, in Zazen, there are many ways this is spoken of, but one of the sort of main ways it's spoken of is that the way we vacillate between dullness and excitement or agitation, which in a sense are different aspects of just denial and grasping. But the sort of exhaustive list of ways in which we create dullness and the ways in which we create agitation are, of course, teachings. They're guiding us to point out, you know, all of the ways that we will find ourselves, all the situations we'll find ourselves in, the states we'll find ourselves in, so that we're not surprised and we can practice it. But what it's also conveying is how many have come before us. And that, in a sense, in that moment of dullness, you're in the midst of a very, very fine lineage of beings who have sat on that very seat, in that very mind, facing that very state. What binds our clear awareness? So in one teaching, it speaks about how mental dullness arises from these factors. Having no control over our sense impressions. Things arise, we perceive them, and we follow. They arise, we perceive them, and we follow. And we follow, and we follow, and we follow, and we follow. Having no control. And that's why it's so easy. It makes sense why we have that experience of, why is this happening to me? Right? I'm sitting here. I have good intention. I'm being diligent. Why does this keep happening to me? And when we see that we don't have control, and of course, this is not a dominating, aggressive control. It's just the ability to direct our mind from what is liberating, away from what is binding. And when we don't have that control, all that's showing us is that that mindfulness needs to be developed. That's what it's showing us. We can't yet, in this moment, assert that power of mind, that mastery of mind. Not knowing when to eat leads to mental. Not knowing when to stop eating. Not knowing when to stop eating leads to mental dullness. And so we practice wariyoki. What is the right amount? How do we tune like a violin, this exquisite instrument? How do we tune the body and the mind and the Dharma? How do we bring them into attunement? When we don't, dullness can appear when we eat too much, right? And because of the rigors of sesshin, there can very often, I think there's very often, a fear, you know, a fear that we're going to die of sleep and we're going to die of hunger, right? Which, of course, has not happened yet in Sichuan. You could be the first. Hasn't happened yet. But that irrational, that illogical fear, right? Something is being threatened, right? And responds with this existential fear. And so that's why, you know, training, practicing again and again, coming through this and seeing it arise and realizing, no, I'm not going to die of thirst or hunger. Not meditating regularly at dawn and dusk. The ancient schedule of the practitioner. Waking up before the sun in bodhicitta, on the bodhi seat, so that then when the sun arises, when the sun rises, it's all there's already wakefulness. Drinking from the spring today, today, today. That is the lifeblood of practice. You know, it's why one of the virtues is constancy, consistency. With anything, it's just really hard to develop something if we don't go back to that spring and drink again and again and again. Not leading a life of awareness leads to dullness. Being unaware seems easy. And it seems easy because we're not aware. It seems easy because we are not actually paying attention. We're not feeling the pain. We're not seeing the danger. It seems easy, but it's not. And there were a lot of times where remembering that was so helpful for me in the moments when I thought, I can't do this. This just isn't going to work. And as I thought about where the image that would appear in my mind actually was being on a train. That was the image. And that up to encountering the Dharma, I'd gotten off at different stations. Gotten off, wandered into town, seen the sights. Nah, this isn't going to work. Get back on the train. Go down the road a little bit. Get off at the next station. Check it out. No, this isn't going to work. Get back on the train. And that when I encountered the Buddha Dharma, that was the last station. No more train. No more railroad. That was my conviction. Right? That was my confidence. I just knew that somehow. And so when I felt like, okay, I need to get back on that train, I would remember, oh, it's not coming. Right? I used it up. This is it. So I better make this work. And that was so helpful. Not training our mind to be resilient so that it becomes prone to dullness, drowsiness, and sleep. Training our mind to be resilient, to be pliant, to be flexible, these wonderful qualities. Right? That's why bamboo is historically in Buddhism, certainly in Zen, is considered such a wonderful example of bending, being resilient, pliant. Not breaking from rigidity. Not developing the skills to better our situation. If we can, why don't we? Why shouldn't we? It's hard enough, right? It's hard enough. So why not, if we can, make our situation better? You know, sometimes speak about how difficult it is to practice, and when they describe their lives, I'm like, yeah. No kidding. Little wonder. And so then I ask, is there anything you can do? Any skills you have, any skills you can develop, any points of access to improve your situation, make it easier for yourself? And then my personal favorite, being plain lazy. Right? Sounds like a parent. You're just plain lazy. Just being plain lazy. And when I encountered this, I thought, it seemed so simple. I thought, are there other kinds of laziness? Being plain lazy is one kind. And indeed, I happened to come across a teaching that said there are three types. You can be plain lazy. You can be lazy by idleness, just dawdling. And you can be lazy by indifference. So rich is laziness in its possibilities. And of course, we all have moments of laziness. I have moments of laziness. It's not a crime. It's an inclination. It's a road we can go down. It's a habit we know. It's something that seems easy in that moment until we look closer. It's sort of like the expression of, I'm going to live long enough. I'm in control of this. Maybe I'll live forever. So, not generating interest, not raising bodhicitta. It won't always come to you. You know, when we just feel enthused, vibrant with the Dharma, with motivation, that's easy. And it's nice, it's powerful. Utilize it. But when it's not there, that's also extremely important. How do you generate? That is the power of your mind. That is the power of our thoughts. That's the power of bodhicitta. That's the power of language. To express that which you need and in the moment feel in short supply of or have little access to. Give it a voice, the yearning, the wish for, the aspiration, the intention. When we really begin to understand how powerful that is, we utilize it all the time. First thing in the morning, you bring that to mind. All throughout the day, at different moments, you bring that to mind. You generate interest. Because we see what a difference it makes. You know, it's one of the most difficult things to do is to practice when you feel indifferent, dull, apathetic, not caring, over it. Not engaging in clear seeing, in the deep insight of the meditative mind, or not training in calming of the mind. Those two essential elements, the two hands of the one body that we call Zazen and mindfulness or meditation, which is really just being. When we don't engage, train ourselves in mindfulness and bring forth that clear insight, that leads to dullness. We turn it around, that means that mindfulness itself brings forth energy, brings forth vitality, aliveness, and certainly insight does this. Getting obsessed with certain aspects of the practice and forgetting others. It's very interesting. Getting obsessed with certain aspects and forgetting others. When Dada Roshi told me that when he talked to Maizumi Roshi about wanting to make this an art center, Maizumi Roshi, his teacher, was concerned because he said, you know, in China and then even more so in Japan, the stronger the arts became, the more negative effect that had on the essential aspects of Buddhist practice. And I think about that because it's a redirecting of energy. It's a redirecting of attention, right? Into something that is Dharma, that can be very valuable, very powerful in terms of helping, being an aspect of the practice, but when it actually takes us away from the essential elements of the practice, those things that you cannot forget, that we should not forget, we should not slide, then something else happens. And I was thinking about this in terms of, you know, the popularization as Buddhism becomes more and more popular, that that's an inevitable consequence. It's an inevitable, I say that because it's always seems to have always happened historically, that the more popular Buddhism becomes, which seems in so many ways a positive thing, a good thing, more people being exposed to the teachings, more people encountering the possibility of meditation. But as it spreads horizontally, right, it first has to take the form that can move horizontally, right? It has to be accessible in a way that is popular, that becomes popular. And that sets up its own entire cycle, right? It doesn't begin that way, but it's a kind of inexorable cycle that is self sort of strengthening, self-reinforcing. And we're certainly in the midst of that. And it's moving fast, fast. Right. This is just what we know, but if you think historically how long things took to just take root, right, for things to develop, for things to spread, for things to come into being, it's moving so fast. And of course, that's one of our challenges, is that it moves so fast that, you know, we're just looking for the next thing. It's hard to actually see what's happening, what's actually going on. What are the consequences? Allowing the mind to become completely dark and dull and failing to take joy in the object of meditation. Failing to take joy in the object of meditation, in your breath, in your koan, in your awareness, in your visualization, that leads to dullness when there is no joy. One way I think of this is, let the fighting be over. Could we please let the fighting be over? Fighting the mind, fighting what arises, fighting the body, fighting meditation. Fighting, 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 fighting. And when we stop fighting, joy is born. After the Huizhang passed, the emperor called, summoned this other teacher, Dan Yuan, and told him the story. And Dan Yuan said, as a way of speaking about, what is this seamless monument? How does it appear? Dan Yuan said, south of Zhang, north of Tan, south of Canada, north of Mexico, therein is gold filling the whole country. Under the shadowless tree, the communal ferry boat in the crystal palace, no one knows. Under the shadowless tree, the communal ferry boat, carrying everyone across. It's communal. It's just a boat, but it holds everyone. Here in the crystal palace, no one knows. The Buddhas can't do anything about it. They can't save you. And you don't need to be saved. When the self is released, it's round and full. We can pivot easily. We no longer have to drag things along. When the self is realized, it's solitary and transcendent. There's gold everywhere. And this gold has no value. No value. It has no shine. And because it has no shine, it's radiant. You can't buy it, you can't sell it, you can't steal it. What is it? A monk once asked another teacher, what is purity in all places? What is this seamless monument? What is this selfless self, this Buddha nature? And the teacher said, breaking a branch of jewel, every inch is precious. Cutting sandalwood, each bit is fragrant. There's a story of somebody went into the market to buy some meat and went to the butcher and said, cut me a fine piece. The butcher threw down his knife and said, sir, every piece is fine. Under the shadowless tree, no one knows. What is it to cast no shadow? To have no reflection? What kind of state is that? You could say it's all illuminated, or you could say it's all dark. The essential is that it's all. Nothing is left out. Another master said, referring to this communal ferry boat, he said, you're crossing over in the same boat, so why worry that so many different people are riding with you? Why worry about all these differences? It's no worry at all. This means that with the same body, a common life, benefit and injury are shared. Don't worry about these different bodies because they're not. And that which is not different appears in all of the differences. In that same body, we share a common life. We share benefit and we share injury. We suffer together and we're liberated together. It's always been that way. It can only be that way, just because that's how things are. When we turn against that and fight it, there will be trouble. Sure as the sunrise, there will be trouble. When we shift and pivot, and release, and see, and move in accord, there will be joy, as sure as the sunrise. Right now, you don't lack anything. Meeting difficulties is not a sign of lacking. So there, arrive in the place where there are no seams. The broken branch is nothing but the seamless monument. When the cup falls and shatters, each and every piece is that seamless monument. The cup was already broken, already passing, just as we are already dying. Always precious and fragrant. When we raise bodhicitta, when we bring forth that intention, that's what we're generating our faith in. And the power of the mind is you can believe that and doubt it at the same moment. In fact, you almost certainly will. And that is not a problem. That is not in and of itself a conflict. You can trust in yourself and doubt that very self at the same moment. And that is not in and of itself a conflict. So when the conflict arises, Stop. Look. The construction has ended for today.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.